Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today on the program is David Hunter. He has 47 years experience as a contrarian macro strategist. You can find him at Dave H. Contrarian on Twitter, and he's one of our absolute favorite guests to have on the show. How are you today, David?
I'm good, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back as always. So, David, going back a little bit, you keep telling us that we're in a final parabolic leg of a 38-year secular bull market. You're saying that we're approaching this melt-up top or blow-off top, and there's a global deflationary bust coming. So why don't we start by kind of reviewing your thoughts on what's happening and where we are in the current cycle, please?
Sure. Taking all the way back, you know, the origins of this, what I call secular bull market, started in 1982 when we came out of the recession, or where the market was beginning to discount us coming out of a recession of the early 80s. And that was the beginning of kind of turning the tide on inflation. Inflation back then was close to 20%. It was really hard to see, looking forward, any chance that we were going to defeat inflation. But we had Paul Volcker in at the Fed, and he specifically turned a very interest rate-driven policy into one where rates went wherever they were going to go, and monetary, you know, the money was what was going to be controlled. So they pulled, money had been out of control, and he pulled it all in. That pushed rates through the roof in the early 80s, you know, 1980-81. And that was the beginning of what it took in terms of very difficult medicine to break the back of inflation. It didn't do it initially. It didn't do it right away. It took many cycles, but we ratcheted down inflation from 20% down to where it's, you know, maybe 1% now, certainly close to zero, over, you know, 39 years. And 1982 was the beginnings of a secular bull market in stocks that maybe nobody knew it at that time, but was the beginning of that multi-cycle ratcheting down of inflation. And by ratcheting down inflation, you also ratcheted down interest rates from 15% long bond to where it got down to 1%, and 10-year, you know, similar 15% down to, you know, 0.4 this year. So when you get rates moving down, inflation moving down, rates moving down like that, what you get in inverse is the ratcheting up of PE multiples over many cycles. So PE multiples back in the early 80s were in the single digits, and now PE multiples are over 20, market multiples over 20. So what you get is this big benefit of ratcheting down inflation, ratcheting down interest rates, and having valuations move up as you have lower interest rates. So we're nearing the end of that, and we're, you know, very close to zero inflation, zero interest rates. I think next year in a global bust, you'll see that. But before we get to that, what I call second stage of a global bust, you get a final blow off in the stock market. Markets go to excesses. All markets move from, you know, bottom left to top right. And in the last stages, they can go parabolic. And that's what I think we're seeing now. And I just think you've got, you know, a couple more months to run in the secular bull market. And then sometime next year, probably sometime in the first half of next year, you begin to deal with the other side of the mountain in terms of a deflationary bust, taking earnings down dramatically, taking lots of companies down as we go through an involuntary debt liquidation cycle. And so we're late in the game, but we still have some fireworks to go before this thing is over.
So, David, as we talk about this melt-up, and we all know that coming into this election, things are very uncertain. There is no stimulus package as of yet on October 22nd when we're recording this. And you and I were speaking before the call about how your view is that that doesn't necessarily matter because it's just a single event that people are trying to point to, right?
Yeah, the timing of it doesn't matter. Obviously, the economy needs a stimulus package badly. Yes, we're going to see a GDP print in another week or a little more than a week for the third quarter, but probably, if you believe the estimates, it's probably going to come in over 30% annualized, probably maybe as high as 35% annualized. And that's a number unheard of. We have never had that I remember to have been in that level. But we also had the annualized 30% down in the second quarter. So this is coming out of a trough, a big percentage back up. But it's a very uneven recovery. Some things are doing great. The benefits of the shutdown are things like Amazon and, the social media stocks, et cetera. The Zooms of the world. It's been a phenomenal time for them. It's been a pretty phenomenal time for, housing's come back strong because of the dramatic money that's been put into the system. There's been pieces of the economy that are doing very well, but then you have the other parts of the economy like, lodging and restaurants and airlines and anything connected with travel that's been hit really hard because people obviously are not going anywhere, and including not into restaurants. So, you've got millions of people who are in places they never envisioned being. Lots of successful small businessmen who have had their lives turned upside down by this and have no signs that they're getting out of it. So we do have a very strange time where you're going to have statistically an economy that looks like it's humming. Autos are coming back pretty strongly, and housing, as I said, and the technology side of the world is where you can operate remotely is doing well. But it's just not, you can't go by those statistics and think everything's fine. So for sure we need a stimulus package, a big one, and I have no problem with a $2 trillion package. I have problems probably with how it's going to be spent, where it's going to go. There's going to be a lot of waste in there. But I think you're better off in a time like this. This is something we just unprecedented in terms of what the virus has done to the world economy and certainly the U.S. economy. I think you want to err on the side of too much. And that's going to be problematic down the road, but you got to deal with the problem right now. So I have no doubt we're getting a stimulus package, whether it comes before the election or after the election. It's great fodder for traders and, the TV, the business news TV folks and lots of people on Twitter. But frankly, it doesn't, the market, it can influence the market on any given day or any given week or even, for a month, but it's not going to stop the melt up. The melt-ups, we are going to get a stimulus package. We do have, a lot more liquidity that's going to be going into this market. So, I view it as if you're a trader, you may want to pay attention to it. But if you're a strategist like I am, it doesn't change my forecast.
So, David, I think an important distinction that I'd like you to make here is bust versus depression and which scenario you think is going to play out.
Okay, sure. Yeah, the word bust gets thrown around a lot, and people sometimes use it as if they're talking about a stock market bust and stuff. I use bust specifically as an economic term to differentiate it from a depression. It's something that I think will be more dramatic than anything we've seen in the post-World War II era, including 2008-9. So bigger than 2008-9, steeper, more damaging, and probably the magnitude of a depression in many ways, but something that happens very fast, more like 2008-9 in terms of speed. So it's not a drawn-out depression. So I contrast it from a recession. It's much worse than a recession and has, does the damage of a depression maybe in a lot of ways, but it's probably contained within a year. So next year I expect a very big unwind in both the economy and the stock market that will be head spinning in terms of how fast things go from not good, but maybe okay, to awful. And, the triggers can come out, come fast and furious. So I hear people throw around the term bust and misuse it a lot. I started talking about a global deflationary bust, I think back in 2013, and not that it was going to happen immediately, but that it was coming, and it certainly took longer to get here than I would have thought then. But I, because of all the leverage in the system, I felt we were ultimately going to end the cycle in a bust, and that's what I meant by a bust.
Excellent. So, David, when we think about once this bust comes, you always say a deflationary bust, right? So can you explain to us what we can see and what your opinion is on the deflationary and then inflationary cycles that we're going to see maybe, let's say, for the next, looking out maybe 5 to 10 years?
Sure. Yeah, keep in mind, we have not had a widespread deflationary downturn since the Great Depression. So the 1930s was the last widespread, global deflationary event. Japan's, went through several years of what I'd call mild deflation, benign deflation back in many years ago. And people seem to think, because that's the most recent example of deflation, that that's what we're heading into. I just caution people, the deflation we're going to see is going to be something much more painful than that, much bigger deflation, could be negative 3 or 4 or 5% inflation, which is what deflation is, negative inflation. So it's not going to be like Japan. We're not going to be kind of saying, the economy's stable and, you got some advantages here because, the cost of purchasing goods is cheaper. No, it's going to hit, unemployment. It's going to hit, which we've already been hit hard. It's going to hit housing. It's going to hit, most assets, particularly, stocks. And it's going to hit prices across the board in ways we haven't seen in previous recessions. So you will have negative inflation of substance. It won't be a long-lasting deflation because of all the liquidity being pumped, starting back earlier this year. And I think, as I've said before, we're looking at a Fed balance sheet that's $7 trillion plus right now. Before this is over, meaning by the end of next year, I fully expect the Fed balance sheet to be upwards of $20 trillion, maybe higher. So that's a lot of liquidity to be pumped in. It will mostly come after the damage, in other words, in response to the bust, because the bust is going to come fast and furious, and by the time they figure out what is needed to deal with it, what I call right-sizing of policy, even a month or two slowness is going to be a lifetime of damage, or at least a depression's worth of damage. So things are going to unravel quickly, but they will keep pumping and keep pumping until they finally right the ship. And then there's long lags. There's a long lag to when the money you put into the system turns into economic activity and growth, and there's an even longer lag to when that turns into inflation. So it will take, coming out of deflation, it'll take 2 or 3 years probably at least 2 years, to see any meaningful inflation. You'll start getting back into positive territory again probably as soon as 2022. But in terms of, inflation that we're worried about, that above 2 or 2.5%, it might be 2023 when we get above that, and might be, and then it might start moving up more quickly, and by 2025-6 you could be, high single digits or moving towards the double digits. Because once this thing catches fire, you will see the inflation move up the other side of the curve very fast over time. But like I said, the first couple of years coming out of deflation will be a gradual move back into inflation. So at least that's my guess. All this stuff can happen differently than you plan. But that's normally the case, is, you've got to kind of repair things before you get into overheating. It's where the inflation really starts to take off, which I think is middle of the decade, meaning 2025-26, is when the economy starts really overheating. And because of all the fiscal stimulus that's going to be done, not just here in the U.S., but around the world, because of all the money that's going to be printed, I think you will see an overheating like we haven't seen for many cycles, more like the 1970s by the time we get to 25 or 6. And that's where you can see inflation all of a sudden move into double digits and then move, up from there. And that's a whole different ballgame. As I've said before, I was around. I started in 1973, so I was around through the whole 1970s inflation into early 80s inflation blow-off. We haven't had anything like that in the last 3 or 4 decades. So, most people that are in this business today are in for, I think, a real surprise. You can read it in the books, but it it's really quite a different thing experiencing it firsthand.
Mm-hmm. So, David, can I get your thoughts on the fact that the Treasury is basically holding somewhere around $1.7 trillion in cash? Like, how does that fit into the puzzle?
Yeah, I would say we had that initial pump of liquidity in the initial, relief package or the first few relief packages. The government, by their standards, for sure, dealt with all of that pretty quickly. And the Fed, I think, did a really good job of reversing themselves and understanding how much they had to get on board. And, they went way beyond anything that they had any historical precedent for. So I give some strong grades, some good grades to both Congress, the president, and the Fed in terms of moving relatively quickly back in the spring. And that led to this, what we're going to see now with the lag, very strong third quarter, and that will carry into the fourth, not be as strong as third. But, the Fed, rightfully so, because they were in uncharted territory, got a bit nervous, in the summer and paused. So they basically went from, they got up over $7 trillion, and then they backed off of, a few hundred billion in terms of their money, their balance sheet. And that has led to some backing off of the economy so that it's, we're still up, we're still moving up, but at a slower pace. And, and that's what's got Wall Street nervous. I think the feeling is that, we had our benefits of the liquidity pump, and now it's going the other way. Well, I think it's going the other way, but if they, if once the stimulus package comes and the Fed feels they've got the company of the Congress again, you'll see both the Fed balance sheet expand and stimulus, and we'll pick right back up again. But in the meantime, this stuff is uneven, and you've got programs out there, and, some of the stuff can be put to work very quickly, and some of it not so quickly. And I do take Congress to task some in that they don't seem to necessarily feel the urgency that somebody who's going to lose their house because they no longer have any income, or their business, their restaurant's been shut down for 6 months, or, what have you, people, all the millions of people that lost jobs because those businesses got shut. The Congress is getting their paychecks regardless, and they don't seem to have the same sense of urgency that things are bad. They see the stock market up, they see, lots of big businesses thriving. And I don't think they really grasp, that we've got a very big chunk of our population that's suffering. So, some of that money, I don't know the details of that $1.7 trillion and why it's not out there. Some of it's programs that just aren't necessarily being demanded of. It takes two to tangle. If, whether it's PPP programs or what it is, if people are not partaking, you aren't necessarily going to get the money out there. It's not just from the side that has the money that's being stingy. My sense is they want to get this money out there. And I don't know exactly what the makeup of that 1.7 is, but it's what I call friction in any of this stuff. It's not a sign that it's not needed. I just think it's, so many of these things got rushed into the system, and not all were administered properly or in a good way. And of course, there's been some fraud too. People have taken advantage of the money, which always happens. And so I think it's just going to take time to work through some of that. What was efficient is the $1,200 checks that went directly to people. That was efficient. The increased $600 unemployment benefit, that was efficient, although probably some people got it that didn't need it. But some of these other programs where you have to use the banks to get it out there, and the banks use different different banks use different guidelines and loan restrictions, may be part of the reason it's not there. This stuff, when you start talking about pumping many, many trillions into an economy quickly, there's going to be inefficiencies, and there's going to be things that are done that shouldn't be done. And, when you do the report card after the fact, there's going to be a lot of things you're going to say, man, did they waste a lot of money. That comes with the territory. But the more important thing is, if we don't get this economy on its feet and sustained, and obviously I don't think it will be sustained next year, there's going to be so much more cost once you start seeing a financial crisis with banks failing around the world and, you know, a lot of bankruptcies among corporations and individuals, you know, the cost there and the amount it's going to take to bring them back from that hole is even more excessive. So I just hope we can do this as efficiently as possible, because the more efficient, the less the damage.
And that was something else that was on my list to ask you about, David, is a banking crisis as part of this bust. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think we are definitely going to see a banking crisis that's probably bigger than 2008-09. As I've said often, I think the banks that are most vulnerable are over in Europe. I think the U.S. banks were the ones that really took it on the chin and were unprepared in 2008-09. I think they got religion, so they're in better shape. It doesn't mean they won't. There's so much counterparty risk that if Europe's banks suffer or Asian banks suffer, you know, it's gonna spill over here, and I would not be surprised to see a major bank go under here. But the bigger risks are over in Europe and Asia, I think. And Canada, frankly, Canada was in great shape in 2008-09. You know, they were nowhere near as leveraged or extended as we were. I think this time around, you know, their real estate and their banks are more like we were back in 2008-09, I believe. So Canada's, you know, vulnerable here. But basically, if we have a global bust, I think what we're going to see at some point is a financial crisis the likes of which, in terms of speed and magnitude, we haven't seen. You know, 2008-09 was an eye-opener in terms of how fast that came. I think this could even be bigger and faster. So it's going to take a lot more response from the Fed and the other central banks. It's going to take, obviously, congressional response. And they have some ability to draw on what they learned in 2008-09. In 2008-09, that was so unprecedented that maybe this time they'll be a little bit faster in terms of the response. But given, unfortunately, given the dysfunction in our government today, I have real concern anyway that they can't move fast on anything. But they will be forced to, because this crisis, I think, is going to come fast.
So, David, when we're talking about real estate, we had a listener submit one question about what your thoughts are towards what's going to happen to real estate in this cycle as well. So can you share with us your thoughts on that?
Sure. At least here in the U.S., and I can mostly comment on that more than elsewhere, but in the U.S., you know, we're seeing that housing is really strong right now. It seems so counterintuitive to have such a strong housing market right now when, you know, the economy is in such rough shape. And it's that unevenness of this economy. But it's a combination of a lack of inventory, you know, obviously people moving out of the urban centers because of what happened due to COVID-19, the shutdowns in those cities, and the fact that the cities got hit hard, at least particularly in the Northeast, in terms of the COVID cases, et cetera. So you have people wanting to leave the urban centers for the first time in a long time. I mean, it's been, you know, real, the cities have drawn people in, and now those people are exiting. Tax policies, government policies are, I think, causing people to want to flee the cities, and not to mention the whole law and order thing and what's going on with Antifa, et cetera. People are really saying, I'm done. I don't want to take the risks, or I don't want my family at risk here in the urban center. And so you're seeing, you know, an exodus from there, and it's putting upward pressure on housing prices in the suburbs and in, you know, states away from the urban centers. And that's kind of helped this last 6 months of activity. Probably carries on for a little bit longer. I think the bust will interrupt that. I don't know in terms of, you know, it depends a lot on what happens with a vaccine and whether we can really get the cities back on their feet again, you know, within a year. That could slow or stop the exodus. If not, you're going to see a continued exodus and, you know, probably see an imbalance of prices where the urban centers continue to suffer price erosion and the suburbs particularly those attractive suburbs that people are fleeing to, will get benefits. But in the meantime, you also have interest rates, which right now, you know, you can get a sub 3% mortgage. And I think before we come out of the bust, I wouldn't be surprised to see a 2% mortgage next year, because I'm expecting a 0% 10-year next year. So, you know, rates are as low as they can be. That's going to be obviously a wind at your back for the next year. However, you know, the economy is going to be a huge tailwind. In other words, if we're going through a financial crisis and, you know, big unemployment, we're already in it. But, you know, the second stage of it next year, you know, I think it's going to really stop real estate in its tracks. And despite low rates, the deflationary bust basically sends prices down next year. I don't think it'll be, and again, I'm talking about the U.S., I don't think it'll be as bad as 2008-09. We don't have the subprime issue, et cetera. But it could be pretty bad. You know, you could see double-digit losses, and certainly, you know, significant double-digit losses in real estate values. So you could still see a 20% decline in housing prices. And then on the other side of it, you know, if we get a recovery starting in 2022, you could have a period 2022-23 where you still have relatively low rates. You know, mortgage rates might be back up to 3 or 4%, maybe even a little higher than that, but where you're in recovery and you could see some rebound in housing for a year or two out of the bust. But ultimately, given what I said before about where interest rates are going, I believe, by the way, I should make this statement, I believe the inflation cycle that starts, let's say, 2022 and goes through the most of the decade, I think we could retrace the entire inflation and interest rate move that we've had over the last 38 or 9 years. So, you know, if you say inflation came down from 20 to negative 3, you could go from negative 3 or wherever deflation is back up to 20. If interest rates came down from long bond came down from 15%, and or I'll use a 10-year came down from 15%, goes to 0, you could see it go from 2022 to 2030, go from 0 back up to 15. That's a huge move in less than 10 years. I mean, that's unheard of, and I could be wrong, but that's what I think the risk is, given all the liquidity that's being pumped, that we get an inflation cycle unlike anything we've ever seen, even bigger than, you know, the 1970s. And that, you know, if, let's say, you get to the mid-2020s or 2024, 25, and you've got mortgage rates moving towards double-digit and then ultimately into double-digit, that's a very, very big tailwind that, you know, prices are pretty much the inverse of your mortgage payment, you know, or your interest rate. If your interest rate is 2 or 3%, obviously your mortgage payment is way down. If your interest rate on your mortgage is double digit, you know, your mortgage payment, that's a huge change in the mortgage payment. Most people are buying houses today based on how much they can afford in a monthly mortgage payment. So that becomes a very, very big headwind, probably starting in about 2024. Could be a little sooner than that if rates move up faster. So I don't, there's a lot of people that think real estate is an inflation hedge, and they think that, you know, and we'll talk about it, I'm sure, before I finish this interview. You know, we talk about gold and silver being big winners in the inflation cycle, and I have people always asking me about real estate. Isn't that a good inflation hedge? And I go, totally different story. I think inflation is going to really hurt real estate. So because of interest rates and the big role they play on the value of houses, I would not look at real estate in the next cycle as a beneficiary of inflation.
Perfect, David. I'd like to move back a little bit to the melt up as you talk about. So you're saying that tech, industrials, miners, and energy stocks will be leaders here. So when this bust happens, in your opinion, what do you think is going to happen to the metals prices and also, let's say, prices of miners? Is that going to be another buying opportunity presenting itself, or do you think that they're going to hold fast?
Yeah, I don't think they're going to hold fast, but I don't think they're going to go down nearly as much as what the stock market's going to do. So, you know, I'm in print and on record as saying I think we'll see gold at 2,300 to 2,500 this year in this melt-up period, and silver up to 35, 36. My guess is from there, and again, timing can be off. If the bust doesn't come early in 2021, then, you know, maybe they have a little more legs than that. But those are my targets, and I'm assuming we'll have a bust in, you know, beginning sometime in the first half of next year. So that I think the likelihood is from those targets, you might get something like a 30% pullback in prices. So back to the low to mid 20s in silver, back to say 1800 on gold. Let's say if you're 2500, you go back to 1800. It's a substantial correction, but it's nowhere near what I think the stock market's going to do. But the real story is that, you know, I'm looking for gold at 10,000 and silver at 300, 10,000 plus, and silver at 300 plus in the inflation cycle that follows, so in the ensuing decade. So to me, you know, for a lot of people, they may not want to try to figure out what happens in the bust with gold. Yes, it's not going to hold all its value, my guess is, but it'll hold a lot more of its value than some of the alternative assets that you might put your money in. So, you know, people have to kind of determine for themselves what their comfort factor is in terms of riding through things. But basically, I think we have begun, you know, when gold turned the corner and silver turned the corner in the last couple of years, we've gotten the next leg up in what I think is going to be a stunning bull market.
So another piece of this, David, that I'd like to get your take on is you're saying that the dollar will be neutral to positive along with treasuries when this happens. So can we get your, let's say, longer term view on where the dollar is headed and also the correlation to, let's say, dollar weakness versus gold strength and how you think that's going to play out as well?
Sure. So, you know, just to kind of bring it to present, you know, I'm still calling for 85 on DXY, so 85 on the dollar here short term. So from, you know, where we are now, still a substantial hit to the dollar. And most of that, I think, happens, you know, between now and year end, if not all of it. And then in the bust, I think the dollar will be seen as a refuge, as it usually is in times of trouble. The U.S., you know, certainly has its problems today. And, you know, we could talk philosophically about how many problems it has. But it's still the country that people see as the country of laws and stability when the world seems to be, you know, in turmoil. So if we get a bust around the world, I think you're going to see investors around the world say, I want the stability of the U.S. I want the stability of the dollar. I want the stability of, you know, the U.S. system where, you know, there's risks, but you also know that they always kind of defend their currency and they, you know, they have a Federal Reserve that has stood the test of time. So I think you will see the dollar get a bid in a flight to safety move, and quite a bid, in fact. So from 85, I think next year you could see the dollar up to as high as 140. So it'd be a hell of a move over the course of a year. That, you know, more than holds its own. You know, it's one of, as I say, the U.S. Treasury securities, and the dollar may be two of only a very few things in the world that will hold value and appreciate during a time when most assets around the world are depreciating and depreciating quite dramatically. So I think next year is a strong dollar. And then because of the 20 trillion plus balance sheet that I see the Fed going to, and, you know, I don't know what 20 plus, what the plus stands for. You know, it could be 20 trillion, it could be 30 trillion. So, you know, we're talking trillions. These are huge numbers of new dollars that'll be pumped into the system. As we come out of the bust and go through the next recovery, all that additional currency that's out there is going to weigh on the dollar, and you will, I think, see the dollar depreciate through the decade. So, you know, the high water mark, whatever it is, whether it's 140, whether it's less than that or more than that, when it rolls over, I think you will have a steady, you know, it'll never be, it's stair step, so it'll never be a straight line. But you will see a steady depreciation in the dollar that will ultimately, by the end of the decade, I think, take it well below the 85 that we see this year. So, you know, dollar will be seen as a very strong thing next year, but then beyond that, I would say the dollar is going to be under a lot of pressure, you know, over time. That speaks well for gold and silver. I think, you know, a weak dollar will definitely be beneficial to certainly to gold in dollar terms. And it's part of my reason for forecasting 10,000 plus on gold and 300 plus on silver. Obviously, inflation's a big part of that story as well.
So as you've given us your real recovery cycle projections for gold and silver, could you give us a couple more of your thoughts, let's say, in regards to oil, and then maybe some of the ETFs like GDX, SILJ, asset classes like that?
Sure. Yeah, oil's a tough one right now, obviously. I would have thought we'd see a little bit better reaction than we've seen. Actually, the price of oil is okay. It's more what it's done to the oil and the energy stocks that's troubling. But I continue to say that I think oil probably has more upside here in this recovery. You know, it got down, obviously, to negative price for a couple days and certainly went down to $10 on a more, you know, week-to-week basis back in March. And, you know, it's climbed back over 40. I expect we'll see oil at probably 50 to 55 here in the next few months, maybe before the end of the year or certainly, you know, by January. And that should help the energy stocks, as you said before. I don't call them leaders in this last stage, but I do think you'll see a catch-up rally where they could outperform. And, you know, right now you wouldn't believe that because they've been flat on their backs, but I think they're overdue. And then, you know, in the bust, I fully expect oil to go back from, say, that $50 or $55 level back to $10, kind of a retest of March's lows. And then the real story where I think I live up to my contrarian name is I am calling for oil to be as high as $300 or higher by sometime late this decade. So again, fitting in with that inflation cycle, the massive money being pumped, and again, it's not just the Fed, it's around the world. The demand for oil will not be just a U.S. story, it'll be around the world. By the way, I think this recovery that I'm talking about post-bust is going to be the first industrial recovery that we've had since the 1970s. You know, we've been really a consumer-driven, U.S. particularly, has been a consumer-driven economy for the last 40 years. And I think that's going to change. I think you're going to see a lot of industry reshoring, you know, bringing capacity back to this country from China and elsewhere. And I think you're going to see so much infrastructure pump priming, you know, stimulus from governments around the world, that you're going to see a lot of that go into industrial spending. So that's why you get such a big commodity cycle, is because industrial expansion in, you know, demands commodities. And one of those commodities is energy. So energy is going to be in big demand as we go through, and, you know, again, the first industrial recovery since the 1970s. And that's why I think it's premature. I know the, you know, kind of the most popular narrative out there is that we're moving to alternative energy sources and that fossil fuels are dying industry. And particularly if Biden wins, it's curtains for fossil fuels. There is no way, and I mean no way, we will be able to meet the demands that I think are coming in the next cycle without fossil fuels being the center of that. You know, industrial demand, you just are not going to be able to have enough solar or wind power or anything else to offset. So all this, you know, conjecture about fracking and doing away with energy, you know, fossil fuels by 2035, I think is nonsense. Certainly it's not going to happen in the 2020s. And I think we will, by the time we get back to the mid to late 20s, you're going to hear very much hear the peak oil story again, you know, where there's just not enough oil out there to meet the demand. And the good news is you're going to have a lot of that oil that's been shut in, deep water oil, et cetera, that it will become very viable to be drilling for that stuff again if you're talking about, $200 or $300 oil and, $10 or $20 or $30 gas. So, that's what I mean. When I say inflation is going to go through the roof, that's where you're going to see it. You're going to see it in your gasoline tanks. You're going to see it in your heating oil bills. You're going to see it, in a lot of places. Copper, if you're trying to build a house and you need to put it in a bathroom, there's going to be a lot of places where commodity prices are going to be higher than they've ever been in the history. And that takes a toll on discretionary spending, by the way.
Absolutely, David. And just to get your thoughts on where we could see GDX, GDXJ, SILJ, those guys go too.
Sure. Yeah, my targets that I've had for quite some time are GDX. I think we can get to 55 here in this, if gold goes to 2,300, 2,500. GDXJ, the junior gold, can probably get up to 100. And, SIL, which is silver ETF, silver mining ETF, probably 75. And silver junior, SILJ, maybe 30. I'm not sure. So there's, I think, pretty long runway ahead for them. It may come fast. If you look at history and go back and look at charts and things, some of these bull moves come in a hurry. They tend to have their spurts that last 6 months or less. And we've had a nice run out of a deep trough back in March, but there is definitely more upside as far as I can see. It's pretty significant. And then, like I said before, just like the metals themselves, you'll probably see, 30% type corrections, maybe a little more, 30-40% corrections in the miners in the bust. But I'm looking for potentially, and it doesn't mean it has to be 80, could be 65 or 70, but I think the potential is there for the S&P or for the stock market, the broad stock market, to drop 80%. So if these things drop 30 or 40%, that's a huge relative performance.
Perfect, David. Something that you and I were talking about before the call, something that's very, I think, important to highlight here is your vast experience in this space, and you don't necessarily base these forecasts on any one piece of information in particular. So tell us a bit about how you kind of aggregate that data and form that opinion.
Sure. Yeah, I get annoyed sometimes because people will often on Twitter or wherever ask, does the stimulus package, obviously we've gone through for the last month, it's on again, it's on, off again, it's not going to happen, it's going to happen. And you get these questions about, well, it looks like it's not going to happen like you saw it before the election. Does that mean the melt-up's done? Forget that, and you've got to change your forecast. And I go, no, my forecast does not depend on the stimulus package being, even if I thought it was going to happen before the election, the fact that it doesn't isn't significant to whether we get the melt-up or not. And the reason for that is, number one, in that particular case, we're going to get a large stimulus package. How we get there, whether it's before the election, I still think better than 50% odds it happens before the election, but doesn't really matter whether it's before the election or after the election, whether it's under Trump administration or under a Biden, a new Biden coming in. Frankly, I don't think it's significant because the economy and those that are suffering is where it's going to be the determining factor of how large it is ultimately. It may come in stages. It may not all be, we may get a $2 trillion package here soon, or we may only get, pieces of it, or even if we get a $2 trillion package, there might be even a bigger package, sometime in the first quarter. So in today's world of social media and CNBC, et cetera, we kind of live in these, single item events determine market swings, and traders live and die on it. It was a few years ago. It was, is Janet Yellen going to be confirmed? Should she be reconfirmed? And if you remember, we had a few months there, several months, where that was the dominant subject on CNBC and, elsewhere, for as if it was the reason the market was going to go up or go down. And those things are just silly. That my analysis is really the sum of the analysis. It's based on lots of things, and any one thing like that is not going to, I don't put a forecast out of a once in a lifetime melt up based on whether stimulus is going to happen before or after a certain date.
Excellent, David. Well, we really appreciate your complete views here, and it's always a pleasure to really speak to you and get your thoughts on these things. As a reminder to any of our listeners that would like to hear more from David, he has a subscription-based newsletter. And tell us a bit more about where we can find you, David.
Sure. People who want to follow me on Twitter can find me at Dave H. Contrarian. And in terms of my letter, it's by subscription, so it's not a freebie. But if people are interested, just direct message me on Twitter and I'll respond there.
Wonderful, David. Thanks very much for your time today.
Okay, thanks, Tom. Enjoyed it.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.
Think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?